Well, thank you, Paul, and thanks to the APHA for agreeing to this session, which is a little out of the normal mix, I would say. But it's such a pleasure to be here this morning, and particularly being in New Orleans. Before I start, I want to say just a couple things by way of background. CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is a bipartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. I think we were voted number one in foreign policy or national defense in an international poll for a couple of years. But we're one of the big two in foreign policy in Washington, D.C. So nuclear nonproliferation, which is what I do, is one small part of what CSIS does. I'm talking here about nuclear risks today, not the benefits. It's not that I don't think there are benefits to nuclear energy, nuclear medicine, all the rest, but that's not part of what I'm talking about today. And then third, Paul gave me this impossible task. My objective is not to make you experts in 20 minutes, but just to whet your appetite. So there are several NGOs specifically founded by doctors and physicians and researchers. If you want to get more information, and you can always send me an email, but some of the more prominent ones besides Global Green are Physicians for Social Responsibility, International Physicians to Prevent Nuclear War. There's a group out in California, Tri-Valley Cares, which has done a lot of work in looking at the environmental and health effects of the nuclear weapons complex. So there are a lot of resources out there. I can't cover them all here, but I'll give it my best shot. So I'm going to talk about nuclear risks very broadly, the full spectrum. While Bonnie gave you a fantastic description and analysis of what the government is very specifically doing, I'm not going to do that here in nuclear. That would be impossible. But So sit back, and we're going to get a little think tanky about these issues. After I talk about the risks, I'm going to talk about how do you communicate about risks, because I think as healthcare professionals, you do a lot of that, right? Communicating about risks, and then talk a little bit about the opportunities. So nuclear fission, it was developed for war and promoted for peace. And as a result, we have, in my view, you know, three different, and these circles are not really proportional, although I tried, right? Nuclear energy would be kind of off the charts there. But we have nuclear weapons, 17,000 of them right now. Nuclear material, and I very specifically put up there weapons usable material, because that's what we're concerned about, highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium. And then nuclear energy. We have 31 countries plus Taiwan that operate nuclear power reactors. There are some risks associated with those. I've sort of put them together in terms of material, both on the weapons and the material in nuclear energy. You have spent fuel. They all funnel down into what is your nuclear legacy? What's your nuclear waste? We only have one facility in this country, the waste isolation pilot plant out in New Mexico, that deals with defense waste. And, you know, we could talk about waste, low-level waste, high-level waste, disposing of spent fuel or reprocessing and taking that high-level waste. There are a lot of issues there. I'm not going to talk too much about that nuclear legacy, except to say there's a whole raft of issues associated with the impact on the environment and potential releases of radiation to the public, and there's a lot of debate over what's safe and for how long it needs to be safe. There are different risks associated with these three different areas, but all of these could entail a release of radiation to humans and the environment. Obviously, if a nuclear weapon explodes, there's a big problem. I like to think of this in terms of, you know, what's the probability and what's the consequence? So you can have, and I would say you want to keep moving towards that low end, so low probability, low consequence. When you look at nuclear terrorism, the risk of a nuclear of a terrorist group exploding a nuclear weapon, right? That is a low probability, high consequence event. And so you have to deal with that in a certain way. You make decisions about how, what you're going to do to prevent it, deter, how much money you're going to spend. All these things we have, as a country, thought about since 9/11, right? When you have a low probability, high consequence event. So that's on the nuclear weapon side. If it's a radiological device, it's the consequence is lower in terms of the impact, but the probability might be higher. This is just a sketch. You know, you might draw those circles in different ways, and people really disagree on what the probabilities are. But the idea that I just want to leave you with is you want to move down, down towards that low sector. You know, it might be okay if the high, if it's a high probability, but you're still, high consequence, but still in the low probability. Anyway, that's, I said I was going to be think tanky, and I hope I'm delivering. For nuclear weapons, there are a lot of different risks. So you have the risk of use, whether it's intended or unintended. We have things like the fog of war, right? The thing that probably keeps me up most at night is Pakistan. Pakistan's nuclear weapons, whether they're secure, whether they might be either intentionally or unintentionally handed off to a terrorist group, whether you might have either an inadvertent escalation or exchange with India because you don't have a lot of the safeguards, and I use the term loosely, in place. So you have use, theft, the impact on proliferation, the impact on conventional war. There's, you know, there's a myth, I think, somewhat, that if you have nuclear weapons, you won't have conventional war, right? So if Iraq had had nuclear weapons, the U.S. wouldn't have invaded, right? Well, there are a lot of different variables that come into play, but you can actually have nuclear weapons, two sides, and I would say that some people argue India and Pakistan are examples of this, where you have nuclear weapons and it's made conventional war more likely. So there's no black and white here, right? You have to think through all of that. And then finally, costs to society. We spend a lot of money on nuclear weapons every year, more than $52 billion, I would say. I haven't checked the numbers recently. Only a very small portion of that is devoted to the kinds of programs that Bonnie has been championing, these cooperative threat reduction measures. They're costs to society, and they're environmental and health costs, clearly. So that's nuclear weapons. A nuclear material, the risks are a little bit lower, but you have diversion or theft. And what we have been most concerned about is there's a lot of this highly enriched uranium around the globe. And that is, if a terrorist were to get their hands on it, that is a higher, it would be easier for them to put a nuclear weapon together from that HEU. And so that's what we worry about there. And then on nuclear energy and legacy, obviously these unintended releases of radiation and environmental impact. So I'm not going to go through all of this, but, you know, we've gone through an evolution with the U.S. and Russia over decades, right? We're no longer, last I checked, concerned about a massive nuclear exchange. But, you know, relations with Russia right now are at a very low point. I was recently in Vienna talking on a track two basis with some Russians about, well, gee, do you think we could limit our tactical nuclear weapons? These are the non-strategic, shorter range. And we had a good day and a half of discussion with not very much optimism about being able to do that. Let me continue on here because I talked a little bit about this already. The peak of our nuclear weapons stockpiles globally, although U.S. and Russia really are have the most weapons was in the 1960s at 70,000 nuclear weapons. This is, you know, many times the ability to destroy the planet. Today it stands at about 17,000, which is still quite a lot of nuclear weapons. And the one thing I want you to remember is U.S. and Russia have a long way to go here. We hold 95% of those weapons. So what have we done to reduce those risks? Well, we've had bilateral arms control. There's been multilateral arms control, not directly on reducing weapons, but on testing, on nonproliferation. Since the 1970s, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. In the last few years, we've had what we call the P5 annual conferences. So these are the permanent five, the five nuclear weapon states, U.S., Russia, China, U.K., and France, to talk about where mostly it's focused on verification. And then for the past couple of years, there have been these conferences held on the humanitarian effects of nuclear weapons. And the next one will be held in Austria in December. And the U.S. has not, none of the P5 has participated in these conferences. And recently, the United States decided it would join that conference in Vienna. And a lot of the discussions, at least in the previous conferences, have looked at mitigation, response, consequence management, although there are probably some factions of countries who have participated in there that really want a nuclear weapons convention, a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. All right, so we're going to put weapons aside and focus a little bit on nuclear material. There's a lot of material out there. Much of it is in the military sectors versus the civilian sectors. About 85% of that highly enriched uranium is in the military sector. We've been having nuclear security summits, you may have noticed, for the past few years. Started in 2010 in Washington and then moved to Seoul in the Netherlands, and it's going to come back in 2016 to the United States, as Paul mentioned. Today, there are more than 30 countries that have more than 1 kilogram of, highly enriched uranium. And about 11 with separated plutonium. It really, you have to look at the numbers to know that a lot of this is focused in the nuclear weapon states. But the idea has been in the summits that we would secure the most vulnerable material, which is highly enriched uranium, in 4 years. So the summit process has brought a lot of high-level attention to the issues. I don't know if this is the most recent version of my presentation. It seems like there's no end to that sentence there. But we need to look forward to what happens after 2016. We think that'll be the last summit. And as a consequence, I would say we need to strengthen what is right now a very voluntary regime. Countries do not have legally binding commitments to do a lot of things. So just briefly, some of the highlights from the last summit. Japan took 500 kilograms of really weapons-usable material, is in the process of sending it back to the United States. Belgium has also transferred some significant quantities of this material, and the UK is working on defueling and decommissioning its last reactor that was fueled with HEU. These are just a very few examples. We can talk more in the Q&A if you're interested in this. I think some of at least three issues for the next summit will be, how do you get at all this military material, all the material that we haven't covered so far? How do you get at plutonium, because we haven't done so much there? And then what happens next? What kind of governance system do you have following into the future to ensure comprehensive implementation? I have this little segue into nuclear energy on plutonium and spent fuel, because often, at least you know, we look at nuclear energy and we say, well, you know, light water reactors, there's not much proliferation risk. But what we have going moving into the future is a growing stockpile of spent nuclear fuel with nowhere to go. So you may have seen the photos at Fukushima, the accident in Japan in 2011, where the spent fuel pond, we were very concerned about the spent nuclear fuel there. We need to make more progress on the spent nuclear fuel, not only for safety and security, but also for non-proliferation, because it only takes about 8 kilograms of plutonium to make into a nuclear weapon. Now, there are significant radiation barriers, right? When it's in spent fuel, you actually have to reprocess it or separate it. But there's going to be a lot of that material hanging around if we choose to move forward with nuclear energy. And for some countries, that is definitely an option that looks like it makes a lot of sense for them because it is relatively low carbon. So, and I know I'm running out of time here, but nuclear energy, just a few facts. It is often in the press said this is going to be the solution to global climate change. It's not really, although it may be part of the solution. And why? Because it only provides right now 15% of our global electricity generation. It is really geographically focused. I mean, the U.S. has 25% of all nuclear power capacity. And then you've got Europe, and it's growing in Asia. The three drivers are climate change, energy security, and huge growing demand for electricity. But you still have these problems: cost, safety, waste, proliferation, and terrorism. I would say, I mean, it's very hard to say how nuclear energy is going to expand, but no matter what, you need good governance in place, and you need to make some serious decisions about waste. And just to leave you with this, it's not my last slide, but it's almost there. These are the proposed new nuclear states. So these are countries that are all interested in nuclear energy. And remember, when we looked before where nuclear energy right now is, it's not really there, right? It's in all the advanced developed countries. So when you take on top of this map, we'll have to get there in a little bit, governance issues, I'm going to skip to this slide. You can see this is a Foreign Policy magazine does a failed states index. And so the darker the color, the more governance issues these countries have. So black is critical, purple is in danger, and then this light purple is borderline. You can see there's an overlap, right, between countries that are interested in nuclear energy and countries that have some problems in governance. So in general, I would say we have to pay a little more attention to how these states move forward. I'm just going to conclude with two things, communicating about risks and some recommendations about policy. So Bonnie mentioned prevention, detection, response. I forgot detection in here. I put deterrence in there. Mitigation and response. When we try to reduce risks, that's what we want to focus on, right? We don't want to solely focus on response capabilities because that's too late, right? So the question is, when you're thinking about prevention and deterrence and communicating risks, how do you frame that in a way that makes people understand that this is important? And I would really love to hear from you how you do that in your own work. Is it fear? Is it optimism? Is it capability? Is it technological ability? Particularly in, you know, that we have the technological tools to combat this, particularly in nuclear security, you know, the real issue is not how we do this, but it's getting the political will to spend the money on these programs. So how you communicate that risk is very important. Oops, I keep going the wrong way. I'm going to skip the case of Iran. We can, if you have questions on Iran, we can talk about that. I'll leave you with these three things. We need to strengthen the legal regimes governing nuclear weapons, nuclear materials, and nuclear energy. We do need arms control, but when we can't get it, because it's politically impossible, because, say, Russia has invaded Crimea, you need to seek transparency initiatives, track two dialogues, verification experiments. You need to keep trying different avenues, and maybe it's just experts talks. And you need, especially in nuclear security, you need a governance structure beyond the summits to ensure comprehensive implementation. The second thing you need resources. We all need resources, whether it's nationally, regionally, or internationally. For example, how much money we give to the International Atomic Energy Agency. And then lastly, we need public attention and action, and that's where you guys come in. So I will leave you with that. Thank you.